Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. First to the newspapers. Business Post is leading out with its headline, State to get first call on RTÉ land, which is in reference to the Land Development Agency, informing RTÉ management this week of its interest in the Montrose site, which could be valued at net less than 100 million euro for the Dublin 4 campus. They have an off-lead, which is a Red Sea poll, in which voters suggest that they would like to see a cut to the universal social charge, it goes on to say, and suggests that 7 in 10 voters want to see it abolished completely. The Sunday Independent leads with the Quinn Parish priest hitting out a businessman, and that is in reference to a piece written by Father Oliver O'Reilly in the paper on the week Sean Quinn published his memoir. The paper also has exclusive extracts from former CMO Tony Houlihan's memoir, which details his loss of his wife to cancer, but also him very much setting the record straight on the years of COVID lockdowns and restrictions. In the Irish Mail on Sunday, they have a headline, Fears of Sinn Féin Control over RTÉ, and it goes into what it says is now the Cabinet preference for a lower revenue collected media charge of direct funding, so that direct funding isn't the mechanism to fund the national broadcaster. Goes on to speculate that the TV licence of 160 euro could be reduced to a broadcasting charge of 100 euro. In the Sunday Times, it's leading on its joint investigation with the Times and Channel 4 dispatches aired last night regarding accusations made against comedian Russell Brand. Accusations he has strenuously denied, and that story is also covered by the Irish Sun on Sunday and the Irish Sunday Mirror. The off-lead for the Sunday Times headline is RTÉ defends spending 20,000 euro on Rugby World Cup tickets. That's in reference to discounted tickets offered to the RTÉ broadcaster before the current crisis and as part of its role as the official broadcaster for the Rugby World Cup. Our panel today in studio, I'm joined by Professor Lisa Ryan, Professor in Energy Economics in the School of Economics UCD, Andrea Martin, media lawyer and chair of Refugee Support Group Friends of Ascend, Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at the Irish Independent, and Pat McCann, formerly of Dalata Hotels and IBAC. Andrea, to come to you first on that story concerning Russell Brand that is covered by at least three of the papers here in Ireland this morning. You've been taking a look.
Yes, it's the front lead story on the Sunday Times. Serious allegations following a long-term investigation by Times Newspapers and Channel 4 Dispatches programme into allegations of sexually predatory behaviour by Russell Brand. These are allegations which on his YouTube channel he has denied. Amidst this litany of astonishing, rather baroque attacks, he says, are some very serious allegations that I absolutely refute. He maintains that all the contacts, the basis of the allegations, were consensual. Tweeting or posting on social media in his support are Elon Musk and Andrew Tate. So I think when these are your cheerleaders, you may have some difficulty. His publishing house has dropped him. I am perhaps unique among anybody I know in that I read his book Relevution a number of years ago, which was
certainly unique in the studio, I imagine.
And I was sort of derided. Did you really read that thing? And I had a certain degree of sympathy, man of appetites, but he's refuting all the allegations.
Okay, and that story's sure to rumble on. But as you say, refuting the allegations. Moving on to the RTÉ funding crisis, Kevin Doyle, RTÉ management up at the Oireachtas, the question's really moved on to this future funding model for RTE, given that we're looking at figures of up to 50 million needing to be plugged. Where do you think that conversation is at now, particularly at the policy political level? Is there consensus starting to emerge around how you plug the hole?
Well, I think there's a few things happening, and across the papers, I suppose there's a divide. There are the stories around the funding of RTE, and then there are the stories around what everybody thinks and every columnist thinks of the new Late Late Show.
We'll come to that in a while.
So that's where RTE is today in the papers. I think there does seem to be a growing consensus now that the government want to find some way to reform the TV licence, which obviously has been put on the long finger forever, because you get no votes for doing any sort of tinkering with anything that is a charge on households. But the time has come. It has gone on too long. So we obviously had Mary Lou MacDonald this week saying that Sinn Féin are now moving towards the view that it should be reformed in the way that the Commission on Media had suggested, which was basically take it straight out of taxpayers' funding. It would be up to the government. You would probably do a multi-annual budget. So every October, you wouldn't be going in arguing for an extra million here, an extra million there. It would have to be set out in legislation over a number of years to ensure that. Whereas Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael certainly seem to be, it seems that their direction seems to be more in the space of bring in something that the revenue can collect. So revenue were against this. This has been muted for years. Revenue were always against collecting the TV licence because it is not a tax. It was based on the fact, did you collect a TV or do you have a TV in your house? And that wasn't really something that revenue wanted to start probing in the way that TV licence inspectors do. So what the government talking about is going to a model that actually makes it more of a tax and every household pays for it. That seems to be consensus. The Mail then today obviously going on the idea that the government want to go this route because it would lock out Sinn Féin from controlling the budget
direct
for RTE.
Funding.
So there are wheels within wheels when it comes to it as well, and probably a lot of work to be done before any announcement is made.
Lisa Ryan, so there's the question, as Kevin has articulated there, of either you continue with a TV licence, you find a new form of charge, or it's the direct exchequer funding. In all of that then, the papers are looking today at, well, how does RTE itself take measures to help fund its future working capital and deal with its rising debt situation? And one of the many things being speculated on is the site in Dublin for something the Business Post is leading out on today. What were your impressions of that? Because there's widely different figures,
yes,
from 100 million up to 500 million being bandied around this week.
Yes, well, of course, one of the things that Kevin Backhurst was asked during the week was whether, you know, we're talking about a gap maybe of around 55 million at the moment, depending on how much that revenue has fallen from the licence fee this year. We're not exactly sure how that'll be. But if it's 55 million, you know, whether it'd be worth selling the land. I suppose there's a few things to think about there. One is to look, where is the expenditure coming from? If it's running costs, and there was a lot of discussion on that in the Oireachtas Committee this week, where Kevin Backhurst was asked, you know, what are the cost-saving measures that you're going to put in place? And the things that he was outlining, as some of the politicians were saying, these are just cost-limiting rather than cost-cutting. And, you know, there are things like, you know, the vehicles, the cars that were being given to executives, the high salaries, maybe a recruitment freeze, a voluntary redundancy. So, you know, so I think what we haven't been told exactly is that 55 million gap, how much of that is going to be something that is ongoing year on year and their operating costs that need to come down? Or is there just a big gap this year because, you know, the licence fee hasn't come in? And next year, if everybody does get levied 100 euros, will that be plugged? So that hasn't really come out.
Bigger picture.
And I think that looking at the site, the Donnybrook site for RTE, you know, as you said there, you know, we're not really sure how much it's worth. If, you know, politicians were talking about 400, 500 million this week, but they were just extrapolating from the site that was sold before.
In 2017,
the market was different.
Again.
And the other thing is that the LDA, the Land Development Agency, wrote a letter this week to, or during the summer, to RTE saying, if you do sell that site, we have first dibs on it because you're a public agency and this is the rule that we have to have the first, I suppose, chance to buy it.
And
then the price would be much lower because it's based on socially affordable
housing.
So then it probably would be worth 100 to 150 million. So I would always be nervous, I have to say, about plugging an operating cost gap with a one-off payment and your site and your asset is then gone forever. So I think these are, you know, one's a fixed cost, a capital cost, and one is the running cost. So you'd have to be careful about what you do.
Pat McCann, you've studied a lot of accounts and audited accounts over the years. Like that tension that Lisa is talking about, where you're having to look at your operation costs, but also that futuristic mode. How do you see it today?
Yeah, I think, you know, RTE's problems haven't happened today or tomorrow. This goes back. It's embedded in the organisation where they've had problems year after year. And I suppose an organisation like RTE needs to reinvent itself every so often. And it's been around a long time. And organisations that are around a long time like RTE, if they don't reinvent themselves, they're going to run into operational issues and operational costs. But the idea of selling an asset to pay for operational losses is madness. Because where do you go then if you don't solve the operational problem? You suddenly run out of road that you have no way of actually funding the future.
So would you be going after the cost-saving exercise rather than selling assets?
Fundamental shift in what RTE does and what makes sense for it to do. And essentially, that's really where the important part is. How then can they fund themselves into the future so that they're not a drag on taxpayers on a consistent basis? But the last thing they should do is sell their prime asset. Because I think, like, all that'll happen is that, like, let's say they move somewhere else and they lease it, that'll immediately have new costs coming into the business that they can't afford.
To bring you in there, Andrea Martin, and I should mention that you worked here in the RTE legal department for a number of years ago. But on Pat's point there about a reset, a rethink, remodelling what RTE does, have you given that some thought, given the rolling weeks and months here?
I have given this a lot of thought over the years, and I have a kind of sense that this day was inevitably coming. I felt 20 years ago when I was in here that this day was inevitably coming. RTE's model of operating was established in the early 1960s when RTE was the only source of broadcasting, had the only broadcasting capacity to inform, educate and entertain the nation. Nobody else could afford to do it. We are in a radically different media environment now, and RTE needs to fundamentally and radically rethink what it does. And while I won't endear myself to former valued colleagues and people in RTE, I would go so far as to question, should RTE even be producing programmes? Yes, RTE should definitely continue to do
And you mean specifically entertainment there, do you?
Specifically entertainment, I mean sport. That to be discussed. There is, maybe people will accuse me of being a gamekeeper turned poacher. I've worked a lot with the independent sector over the last 20 years. There is a very competent, well-equipped, well-experienced independent production sector out there. There is a statutory obligation under EU and domestic law to support Indigenous programme making. They must apply money towards doing that. I really question whether they need all these studios, all of these production staff. I'm talking principally about television. There are some really hard questions need to be asked. If there's to be any sale of the site, I would absolutely agree. It cannot be merely to cover operating costs.
But if you are
costs.
The national public broadcaster and you have to stand for informing and educating people, is also not part of that the engage and entertain? Is that not part of what you have to stand for as a national broadcaster?
That can be done through utilising the independent sector rather than having a parallel system of production capacity internally, production capacity externally, managing independent producers as well as internal producers. I'm not saying overnight this needs to change, but a general direction of change, of rethinking about preserving what is best, but having the courage to completely challenge existing thinking. Certain things are taboo within RTE to even raise. There has been a sense within RTE for over 20 years that public service broadcasting is what RTE does. Full stop, that is the definition. That won't wash anymore. And I know this is going to make a bitter pill for a lot of former colleagues, but for example, I think this micromanaging of RTE over 19,000 spent on discounted, validly commercially negotiated discounted tickets, giving them to commercial customers. It's a classic dilemma of RTE needing to operate both as a public body and a commercial entity.
And therein is the tension, isn't it? And maybe, Kevin, to bring you in there, like, where do you think that consensus is at now between RTE, the licence fee being paid or the household charge or whatever that might become, and that commercial element? Because it's often that commercial element that is going to draw the big sponsors, and it may be the reason people are actually incentivised to say, I'll pay my €100 levy or my 160 licence fee. So do you think people are grappling with that enough, as Andrea poses it there?
I think RTE has got itself in a bind over the years whereby, for example, the comparison I give is they go into a bidding war with the like of Virgin Media for Champions League football, so Man City versus Bayern Munich on a Wednesday night, on one hand, and on the other hand they're involved in putting JA matches behind a paywall because they say it has to be commercially viable to have cameras around the country reporting on all the matches on a weekend. And so there is this kind of idea of, are all these decisions being made on their own? So somebody is making a decision around GAA separate to what the bidding rights around.
So you think
Champions
it's too
League.
Siloed as opposed to a joined up vision of what this should be about?
Because I subscribe to what you outlined, Anya, in terms of, I think the media have a role to engage as well as to inform. And it's by bringing people in sometimes through the entertainment part of that, that you actually hold on to them and that they stick and watch prime time or the news or whatever it is when they might not normally. So I don't see that it doesn't have a role in that space at all.
Yeah, it's the cake and broccoli analogy, isn't it?
It is.
That you can do both.
Yeah, and I suppose I would look at it slightly from, you know, coming from the Irish Independent. I think there's lots of media in the country trying to do similar things with much less resources, and RTE has a massive advantage in terms of what it gets from the state and being allowed to do the commercial thing. So it's, I mean, you're right, Andrea, when you talk about the story about the rugby tickets this morning, RTE say that'll be cost neutral in the end because they've sold some of them to staff and all the rest. But it's just the fact that it's front page news that RTE managed as part of their deal for the Rugby World Cup to get some tickets that they could do. They're in such a mire now that they can't actually do normal business because all of us are looking at it. And part of the bigger thing in that story for me is not so much that they spent 20 grand on tickets, but when you actually read down the detail, they don't seem to be able to explain how or why or
and
where the tickets have gone or who.
I see Catherine Murphy of the Social Democrats saying this morning in that context, just more transparency required. Lisa Ryan, on that Mail on Sunday headline where it's talking about that €100 charge, given that it's been 160 up until now and we've obviously seen people defaulting on that, do you think that's a little bit more palatable to people potentially given a cost of living crisis, the inflationary issues, ECB, everything, the perfect storm for people at the moment, that €100 might feel more palatable?
Well, no, I don't. I think it's going to be very difficult to levy that, unfortunately. You know, at the moment, if you look at the polls, we'll come back to that later for the budget. You know, people want tax cuts. They don't want another charge. Historically, we haven't been very good at levying charges, full stop. Irish people have been against water charges, against bin charges. Now we're going to have a media charge. It makes sense to me that we would have a media charge. And I think most people agree that the licence fee isn't sustainable at all. But from an economist point of view, I think €100 charge makes perfect sense. But I think it'll be very unpopular. And can I come back to one other thing that we didn't really talk about there so much, is there was 175 documents that were included in the record in for the Oireachtas Committee this week, and most of the conversation, as far as I understand it, was really talking about how to fund the future
model.
Whereas, you know, there's a lot of documents in there that have highlighted the lack of governance in RTE. I've been on a board of a public agency. I was really quite shocked to read some things about, say, the audit committee. There wasn't an accountant chairing it, and that they didn't meet very often. They didn't have an external evaluation. All these things that are safeguarded in public, you know, code that you have to do if you have a board on a public agency were put in place. And that kind of thing, if it's not in place, then you can't really have any faith that the organisation is going to be run well. And no matter what charge you put on it, you know, if people don't trust that it's going to be managed properly, you've lost, you know, the crowd from the start. So.
I suspect those 160 odd files are making for great reading by the respective various different reports underway and inquiries. We have an email from Joe which says the BBC is a very successful production department, so why not RTE? It could prove to be a big earner for RTE if it is managed correctly. What do you say on that, Andrea? Is there an opportunity here to model in the same way maybe BBC approaches production?
It's a question of scale. BBC have a good production department. They have a huge commercial arm. They can operate commercially. They have the resources to make long-running, high-quality dramas. And RTÉ has done extremely well over the years, like working in conjunction with the independent sector to commission dramas. But it's a question of scale. The market in Ireland is so, the media market is so small in Ireland compared to the UK that you cannot get the economies of scale that the BBC can get. And that has to be taken into account as well, and in whatever funding model is used in the future.
Pat McCann, the Late Late Show had a new host on Friday night. I don't think you generally watched it. Did you tune on on Friday and break a habit?
I haven't watched The Late Late since Gabo retired. So I'm
just
not,
better things
I'm
to
not
do.
An expert. But I suppose just going back to one thing, you know, they got 107 million for the site that they sold. What happened to that 107 million?
Well, I think it's outlined in the article I know you're referring to today, which was back into capital investments, new studios, constantly trying to upgrade and do the scale that Andrea is
but
talking
I think
about.
Fundamentally, if they don't do the things, the basic things, and, you know, cost is a culture within an organisation and how you deal with things. And it doesn't appear to be in RTÉ. But, you know, coming back to the media charge, if, for example, the government want to impose something like that, RTÉ has to have regained its credibility. Like, RTÉ is a fantastic organisation. And if you ask anybody in Ireland, would they like if RTÉ wasn't there? Nobody will ever say that. That's not what we need. We need a very good, independent media outlet, which so I'd be a huge supporter of the content RTÉ produces, and particularly around sport, obviously. And I know people will say,
so you're a fan, just not of the Late Late Show Friday. Lisa, did you watch the Late Late Show? Because obviously we have a huge amount of analysis.
There's a lot of coverage. Yeah, all the papers discuss the Late Late Show. I have to admit, I wouldn't be one that watches it every week. I did watch some of it last night, and I enjoyed it. I think the general analysis in the paper is very consistent across the board. All the journalists writing that they thought Patrick Hilty was competent and warm and friendly, and they thought he did a good job. But maybe, you know, it could be bolder, because I think one of the challenges that we always have with the Late Late Show is that we don't have, you know, we don't have the guests that you're going to get, say, on the Graham Norton show in the UK or something like that. So what can you add as different? And I think Gabo, for example, set the scene when he started asking people kind of difficult questions, societal issues that were raised before. So even if you didn't have, you know, the celebrity, you would have somebody that would be there and really raise something and have an interesting discussion. And I think the discussion in the papers today is that maybe the questions weren't bold enough. The guests were quite friendly and all a bit cosy. And maybe that could go a bit further in the future.
Kevin, what were your impressions? Because we're looking at headlines today. Anton Savage lately was competent and safe, a recipe for boredom, Liam Fake. Wisecracks cannot hide structural flaws of Late Late reform. We have Laura Roddy, Pat Kenny, Keelty's done the RTÉ jokes, now he can move on, and Éilis O'Hanlon. Patrick Keelty is a class act, but he can afford to be bolder.
Yeah, so it's almost like everybody liked the host, but not the show, if that makes sense. I think there's an awful lot of... It's actually nice to see in one way, because we're so good now at criticising everything and dragging everybody down. There genuinely seems to be a consensus that everybody really hopes Patrick Keelty can make a good fist of this. And it's interesting because he is an outsider, but he's also one of us. So he's got this weird thing. It's not like we brought someone in from England and put them on, gave them over our Saturday night show. But at the same time, he's never been an RTÉ man. He's not something that regular RTÉ viewers, someone that regular RTÉ viewers would be overly familiar with. So, I mean, there's no doubt that the show has been Americanized a little bit. Even the look of it looks a lot more like the American chat shows. The monologue at the start, I think, was witty, and I think people would like the idea that he wasn't afraid to have a pop off RTÉ itself. And I know Kevin Backhurst has said it was all in good humour and had a laugh at it as well. So he got off to a good start, I think. There's widespread consensus in the papers. It's so unusual to get consensus across all the Sunday papers among reviewers that the guests were still kind of on C-rate celebrity, and that there wasn't really a big bang name there for him, and that we need to see that develop. But no, as these things go, usually people get, you know, crushed in the first
he's
reviews.
The lactose factor.
It's done pretty well.
He's made an impression. We should say it's Friday night in case people go looking for Patrick Hilty on Saturday next. Andrea, what were your impressions?
I warmed very much to Patrick Hilty personally. Maybe my RTE sympathies that are kind of innate in me still kind of went ouch, ouch at a few of the
but the it opening was, monologue.
He got it over with. I got the strong impression that he was trying to, as the host, he's trying to hold himself back, whereas usually he's the performer. And he's very funny, very witty. I almost found myself wanting to hear more of him, but realising he had to hold back. When I saw, and no offence in person to Tommy Tiernan and Hector O'Hagan, but my heart sank when I saw RT personalities walking onto the set as the first act. And Tommy Tiernan actually referring to the fact that, well, I'm going to be taking Saturday night and you're going to be taking Friday night. And I thought, lads, why don't you go off to the green room and have a cup of coffee and come back when you've got something interesting to say? Which is cruel. Well, not unduly cruel, but they could have, there was a great opportunity missed to have a guest that was outside that kind of, in our own parish of RTE.
And some people would say, well, i.e. budgets, which we've just discussed, maybe they're not there for flying in external international guests. And people would say, well, you should anchor a prime time Friday night premium show in Irish voices, getting diversity of thought and thinking. And maybe that's where it has to go. Is it that it can be names you don't know, but once the content and the stories is good?
I'm going to ask a really big question. Do we need the Late Late Show?
What's your own answer?
You're busy cancelling all of RT this morning.
It's up for discussion. It's up for discussion. The early days of the Late Late Show were society changing. They were so important. There is a wonderful heritage there. But keeping the Late Late Show going because we do it, I think everything needs to be questioned. I'm not saying that a Friday night show isn't needed. I think it is. But does it need to be the Late Late Show, or do we need to reimagine RTE? I have huge affection for, belief in, and respect for the skill, the creativity and the hard work that people do here. But they need to be given an opportunity. No, RTE needs to be rethought.
Lise, what would you give as the answer there? Because the fans of the Late Late Show will say it's a great earner. You can see the amount of ads, you can see there's a sponsor on it. And some people will say, well, you need that shared time as a country to potentially come together. And of course, it's not all 5 million people, but there should be a shared space where you can have discussions, you can entertain, you can share in a moment.
Well, I don't feel extremely strongly about this, I have to admit, but I do think that the Late Late Show does, you know, have a role. I suppose the question would be, what would you put instead? You know, I'm familiar with other countries' TV where I've lived abroad, and I haven't ever really seen a very satisfactory answer to that question. Many countries just put on a film on a Saturday night, or a Friday night rather, on Saturday night as well, or the French put on cabaret or Italian. Like I haven't seen a very good answer to that question. And I do think, as you just outlined there, a common cultural space is very good. I have a sister who lives in Australia. She watches it over there, and it's her way of tuning into what's going on in Ireland. So I wouldn't get rid of it too quickly, I have to say.
Okay, we'll take a quick break back after these.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr sitting in for Brendan. We have Professor Lise Ryan, Andrea Martin, Kevin Doyle, Pat McCann still in studio with us. We're going to go to the Sunday Independent, Kevin Doyle. Obviously, a lot of exclusive extracts from Tony Houlihan's book today, which really touches on a lot of different themes from the COVID management to the passing of his wife.
Yeah, it's over three pages, Áine, and it's a tough read, to be honest, because it's mostly about his wife Emer and her battle with illness and how both he, her and his family handled that. And I have to say, I think there will be people all over Ireland who will see Tony Houlihan in a very, very different light after they read that passage. Take the politics out of it, take the rows about COVID lockdowns and all the rest of it. What that man was dealing with in the background is very hard to comprehend unless you've been through something like that. And it's quite a long read, but he basically talks about things that I never knew, even though I would have covered and you know, COVID very closely and commented on Tony Holohan's performance on shows like this or in the newspaper, how his wife got a delayed diagnosis for her cancer, the upset that caused. She twice went to A&E and was basically told there's nothing wrong with you except a bit of muscle pain before they found out the true extent that it was uncurable cancer, basically. He talks about having to tell that to his children, and how Emer's biggest fear was that she'd never get to see what her children looked like as adults. They were they weren't even teenagers at the time of the diagnosis. And he goes through all of that right up to the point where COVID kicks in and he has to be the chief medical officer and a husband and a carer at the same time. So it's a very emotional read, I think, and anyone who's found themselves in that position will probably struggle with it a little bit. On the other part of it then, there's a separate extract, which is the politics of this. And that in itself is fascinating because we still haven't had our COVID inquiry. We haven't heard a huge amount from Tony Holohan since he stepped away from that role as CMO. But he gets into two things in this, which I think are going to be big problems for the politician to explain. One is the meaningful Christmas of 2020. So people remember that was at the point where Micheál Martin had become Taoiseach. He says 1,500 people died that January, and that a lot of those deaths would have been prevented if there wasn't an economic decision to keep everything running for Christmas. And the other one was that famous interview that Leo Varadkar did on Clare Byrne Live. And I was there that night in studio, and I remember my jaw on the floor when being asked to comment on what Leo Varadkar had just said. But that was the one where he basically said, I'm in charge and the public servants don't have as much skin in the game as the businesses and the people trying to keep their life going. And he said his wife, Emer, was absolutely devastated by that because she was dying a slow death, his words, at that stage. And Leo Varadkar went on and said that she'd been cut off from all her friends. And he was suggesting that Tony Holohan didn't really care about all that.
OK, well, extracts in the Sunday Independent on that today. Moving on and to bring you in, Pat McCann. So we're talking about Tony Holohan there, who at one point was the embattled head for all things Department of Health and COVID, to now someone else who is embattled this week, which is the Garda Commissioner. There's a lot of articles on this today across the newspapers. Ger Colleran, McEntee can't wish away this Garda crisis by ignoring it. We've Conor Lenehan writing in the Sunday Times, if Harris wants to survive as Garda chief, he must listen to his officers. Alison O'Connor has a comment piece, Garda Commissioner Harris's biggest crime, being a Protestant. Now, her article is very nuanced when you get into it and how she articulates some of the issues he's coming up against. What are your impressions of Garda resourcing this question of the rosters and that vote of no confidence in the Garda Commissioner?
Yeah, I think the vote of no confidence isn't that relevant because nothing will happen as a result of that other than to highlight the level of discomfort that's going on in the rank and file members of our Garda Síochána. And I suppose the disenchantment with the force internally. And that's serious for us as a people because we need the Gardaí to be motivated, to be fully in tune with what's going on in Irish society and to give them power and strength to actually execute their job because that's one of the big problems that they have, that they're not really empowered anymore to do what they need to do because they arrest somebody and within 2 hours they're out given the guards the two fingers and it's...
Well, I don't know if all of the facts and figures would bear that out.
When you talk to the Gardaí themselves, they'll give you facts about what actually happens. And the system is almost conspiring against them. And it's all adding to this discontent that's going on within the Garda force, right from the top to the bottom. So there's fundamental problems happening here that if we don't, I suppose, and our government have to deal with this, if we don't deal with it, we will store up more serious problems for ourselves because recruitment and retention is a huge problem for them. And I know they're adding all the time, but they're losing as many out the other end. So it's just running fast to stand still. So I just think that they'll start to lose a lot more of our Gardaí and the brain power that we have within the Gardaí will start to drift. And we as a nation need the Gardaí, whether we like it or not. We all know that if you have a problem and you call the guards, you're delighted to see them. Mm. So we owe them a lot of care and respect, which I think has disappeared from Irish society. So there's a lot of issues there to be dealt with. But I do think that it's something that if it's not cared for and minded, we will have a real, real problem facing us in the years to come.
So, Lisa Ryan, what has been articulated there by Pat is a recruitment problem, so it needs resourcing. You have a retention problem, which then creates this morale issue as well. What do you think the Garda Commissioner needs to now do coming off the back of that vote of no confidence last week?
Well, I think it seems clear that there is a morale issue in the Gardaí, and I think one thing that hasn't helped is the Gardaí feel that he hasn't listened. He's kind of dismissed the fact he said in public that there wasn't a morale issue when clearly there seems to be one there. And so that's something I think, first of all, he will need to listen to that.
Yeah, and, I think he said the vote was a kick in the teeth, but there isn't a crisis.
There isn't a crisis. So I think he'll have to sit down and think about that morale issue. The roster thing seems to be quite difficult to resolve. There seems to be quite a gap. We know that the general public over the last few months has been a lot of talk about wanting more Gardaí, wanting more security on the streets. So people, the general public, want to see more Gardaí, and apparently the difference in hours, the number of hours that you get with the two different roster systems is 500,000 hours. So in other words, the roster system that Drew Harris is trying to bring in place would give you 500,000 more hours of Gardaí on the street, and he says that's what they need. And so the general public on one hand would seem to be on that side. On the other, I think people do support the Gardaí. They want the Gardaí to this increase in morale. So I think, I mean, I'm not an expert in the governance of the Gardaí, but I think it seems to be clear that he will have to listen and sit down with them a lot more carefully. And, you know, there is a lot of discussion of he dismisses, you know, input. And so I think this kind of listening, at least that people feel like they're being heard in the Gardaí, and the GRA need to be talking to a lot more with him.
Kevin Doyle, the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, expressed confidence in the Commissioner this week and talked about it being a personal vote. Do you detect anything in the newspapers today or amongst government circles of any change an attitude on Garda resourcing and ultimately now assisting the Garda Commissioner to fight back on this?
I think the Cabinet are fully behind him. And you have to remember that we lost the last two Garda Commissioners in not great circumstances. I don't think they can afford to lose a third one. So I think there was maybe some eyebrows raised that it was a 99% vote in that vote of no confidence. But then at the same time, it was an inconsequential vote, if you like, because if you went into any big organisation and asked everybody to vote on the CEO among the workers, the odds are, and Pat's laughing already, the odds are that the workers would
find some people disgruntled.
Absolutely. No, yeah, we don't like them. At the same time, if the question was slightly different, like, you'll note that the union leaders haven't come out and called for him to resign. They say that's not really a question for us. That's, you know, so at the same, if the question was something like, should he resign, the vote, the percentages, I think, would definitely be different, because sometimes it's better the devil you know. But the government are behind him. I don't get any sense that they're wavering on that. They'll stick with him. Where it might become tricky, more tricky for Helen McEntee, is if we get into that space of Gardaí refusing to do overtime or blue flu, and these things are now being talked about. And you mentioned the morale thing. I mean, the tagline on the recruitment, which hasn't been going great, was a job worth doing. And I know that in itself was a punch in the gut to many guards. I know it was a joke going around in the WhatsApp group. Oh yeah, job worth doing. You know, the tagline even irked the guards because they feel they have it so tough. So it's a problem that's not going to go away.
Andrea Martin, you made a strong case for the remodelling of ORSI earlier. Do you think there's a case here for a rethink on how we roster, resource,
I
retain
wouldn't presume
Gardaí?
To to say how the Gardaí ought to be remodelled, but there are, I mean, the policing authority is active, politicians are active. Do we need to remodel? All I can say is that as an ordinary punter, 12-hour days followed by 4 days off sounds really family unfriendly. If I was working those rosters, I would find that very, very hard. If I'd got used to working alternative rosters that were more family friendly and was then told to go back, I would be disgruntled as
and it
well.
Seems to have worked, and that's the argument that the new roster now, it has flexibility, it's got good work-life balance compared to what preceded.
And like what Kevin is saying, there is something to be listened to. Now, whether this is a case, what Conor Lenehan says is the sooner Ireland gets back to selecting a Garda Commissioner who rises through the ranks, the better and safer it will be for all of us, which is quite a strong statement. But the question arises, is this a case where a new broom, an alternative way of looking at things is required. I don't know. I don't know the inner workings of the Gardaí, but all I will say is 6 by 12 hour days sounds very difficult to me.
Absolutely requires a lot of resilience amongst Gardaí to actually execute on that rostering. Moving to politics, Kevin Doyle, we have a poll in the Business Post today, a poll conducted by Red Sea between Thursday, September 7th and Tuesday, September 12th. It's a random sample of just over 1,000 adults and was carried out online. What is that poll suggesting today about voter intentions on political parties, but also critically on the budget and the speculation really that we're having about tax cuts?
Yeah, we could almost skip over the parties because they're very similar. There are small movements here and there, but generally within the margin of error. So you can take it that Sinn Féin are still by some distance the most popular party and that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil come behind them, and then the rest are still in the small numbers. So what is probably more interesting is they have asked people about what they would like to see in the budget. 71% saying that they would like to abolish the USC. Now, that's something that I don't have any extra insight on the budget than anyone else in this panel, but I'll tell you now, that's not going to happen. There will be probably tweaks to it, as has been speculated upon, but they ain't going to abolish it because it would be simply, you're talking billions. But the 63% don't expect a budget bounce, which I thought was interesting. But this is probably what it comes down to in the politics. I think the most important finding is probably that 44% support tax cuts and 45% support spending more money on public services. So the idea that you can't please all of the people all of the time is set in stone before the government ever start to work out what this budget is going to be. It's going to be a giveaway budget. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We already know they're going to do over 5 billion on the spending side and 1 billion on the tax side. But I was running through my head this morning to try and think of all the things off the top of my head on you that I could think of that's already been promised or highly speculated upon by ministers. And, you know, the shortlist has mortgage interest relief for people on the back of ECB rises, a childcare package that might include child benefit increases, that they might backtrack on the excise duty hike that's due on petrol and diesel in October, the income tax threshold to be raised, a cut to the USC, the pension going up by at least a tenner, probably more, energy credits, school books for secondary schools possibly made free, a new an increase to the €500 rent credit.
I keep going. The list is long.
We're a long way out, and that's just what's been kind of put out there already.
Lisa Ryan, what were your impressions of that poll, which suggests, you know, the 7 in 10 voters calling for its abolition, but I don't think there's any political party advocating for that. They're all kind of hedging a little bit on reductions. Some are saying a steadfast no to tax cuts. But there's a real, it feels like, binary debate playing out right now between either you do the investment in your public services or you put money back in people's pockets.
Well, of course, most people would like to have both. You know, Irish people historically usually answer these polls with, yes, I would like better public services, more spending on public services. But then in other places in the polls, they'll say, I would also like a tax cut. Now, I mean, that's just not possible. You can't have a tax cut plus increase in spending. And unfortunately, in Ireland, we're not very good at saying, yes, we'll pay more taxes so that we get better at public services. I think it is quite binary. And as Kevin said, there's a huge, it's going to be very difficult to keep everybody happy, which means that probably nobody will be happy. There'll be a little bit of spending increases, a little bit of tax cuts. I don't think, no party is willing to promise that they're going to abolish the USC because they just simply can't afford it. I think it's interesting that apparently in this poll there's been, you know, an increase in the people that were saying that they would prefer a tax cut over a public spending increase, which is usually not the case. And that's really to do with just people are feeling that pinch, the squeezed middle. They really can't they can't afford life at the moment. So things like the free book scheme that has been very, very popular for primary schools, now they're talking about extending that to secondary schools. I think those are kind of low cost, you know, quite very politically positive measures that can be brought in place. Hot school meals as well. These are things that the child benefit that affect a lot of people and will make people feel much more positive towards the politicians. I think we'll definitely see lots of those kind of smaller measures that don't cost quite so much. But it will be very tight. They're definitely probably going to breach the public the fiscal threshold, and they're talking about a 6.1% they're going to spend rather than the 5% threshold.
And in the context of that, Pat McCann, because we see as part of that Red Sea poll today, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, IFAC, again doubled down on its criticism of elements of the proposed spending. They went on to say little to no justification for a further package of once-off measures to help families. They're making the argument, look, energy prices are coming down, inflation is starting to stagnate, you'll eventually start to see that with your groceries. You got to hold fast and not repeat some of the mistakes of the past.
Yeah, I'm not sure that our cost base is going to come down as much as people think. I think, you know, once costs go up, you rarely see, unless, you know, competition changes dramatically or whatever, but it's unlikely we'll see a big drop in costs. And the fact is that, you know, we've had free money for 10 years and suddenly we're in an area now where we're paying interest rates of 5-6%. I remember when I bought my house long before any of you had to buy a house was 18% in 85. That was your interest. Now, different time, different world. But, you know, my view is that interest rates will stay in or around that, probably not come off that. And that in itself will keep inflation moving. But I suppose the other big problem that we have is that what's driving inflation is the amount of money that's in the economies. And you have a lot of money looking for goods and services and nobody to provide them because, you know, everywhere you go, the shortages of people, you can't get people to do things. And that's worldwide. That's not just an Irish phenomenon. It's the same in the US. And as a result, prices are being driven up because in order to attract people, they're paying lots more. And we have this whole issue then of the living wage and the minimum wage kind of going up maybe 12%. So all of these things will feed in, like somebody will have to pay for this.
And it feels like the perfect storm there. Like, and that's coming on the back of the 10th mortgage interest you know, hike this week and all of the factors. What do you think is going to finally be the signal in that perfect storm to see us now emerge out of it? What's it going to take?
I think what you need to see is a drop in inflation. And of course, our problem in Ireland is that we are driven by the fact of what's going on really in Germany. And as long as that economy is struggling with relatively high inflation, we are unfortunately an unintended consequence of the effects of that.
So trickle
and
down.
They will dictate the pace of what happens around interest rates. And that looks like it's not going to move anytime soon because they have a big job to get their inflation in line. And it's going to be very difficult for countries now to get inflation back to what they call the 2%. And that's a problem. So our costs are, I won't say they're stuck in stone, but you know, they're not coming down or easy. They may ease somewhat.
So inflation is the barometer to which we all have to keep looking.
That'll start to give signals that the things are beginning to get back to, whether you call it a new normal or what, I don't know. But it will not be like we had for the last 10 years where we had free money.
Okay, what got us here will not get us
there. Can I just say that economic growth, though, is slowing. So I think that's something that the ECB will be watching before they'll raise interest rates again.
Yes.
So they're trying to balance that out.
Yeah. And you don't think we'll see another hike from the ECB?
Well, I would definitely not presume
We're
to predict
not going
it,
to forecast
but
that
I think
here.
They'll be nervous about doing it, so they may slow down the rate of increase of rates.
Okay, yeah. More after these.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr sitting in for Brendan. We've Lisa Ryan, Andrea Martin, Kevin Doyle and Pat McCann with us here in studio. Lisa, you've been taking a look at energy, climate change in the papers today. We have a headline in the Business Post from Lorcan Allen. Ergrid warns of liquidity challenges as costs soar. What's that about?
So this is an article about our, I suppose, gas generation in Ireland. So coming into last winter, we had the crisis in Ukraine that was causing gas prices to rise. But aside from that cost issue, we also had the physical issue of not enough gas generation because for a multitude of issues, we had a few gas plants that were out of action just through maintenance. We had maybe low wind, some periods where there was low wind. So basically there was a few system warnings that Ergrid issued from time to time to say that the system was under pressure. pressure. And this happens generally in the middle of winter when we have high demand, say at, you know, peak at time of day, which is like 5 to 7 in the evening, and maybe a day that has less wind. So on the foot of that, they commissioned 4 new generators as emergency generators to, I suppose, provide increased security this winter. And this article is really about how the cost of constructing those generators has gone up. It was initially forecast to be about 480 million. Now it's gone to 612 million. And they're now saying it could exceed 1 billion euros.
So not a hole to be plugged.
So it's really very high. And it's due basically to inflation, as we've just talked about. Construction costs everywhere. We've seen that across any infrastructure projects. The costs are really rising. But it is worrying. And so EirGrid has now requested from the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities whether they can raise an additional 135 million next year, which they will levy on suppliers, who will then pass it through to us. So it will be, you know, a charge.
We're seeing the energy prices coming down, but this could now trigger increases yet again.
So if you look at our energy bills, they're basically made up of, you know, about 40% comes from the cost of actually producing that energy, and then the rest comes from the network charges, from taxes, but a lot of it comes from those grid standing charges that we have to pay, and this would be falling into that. Renewables are bringing the cost down. We no longer pay the PSO levy because it's no longer needed, because the cost of wind has come down so much, but we will always have these fixed charges associated with just providing that infrastructure. So this is very interesting. At the very end of the article, they just mentioned briefly the LNG terminal permission that was refused this week, which got a lot of airtime yesterday. In fact, it's surprising there isn't more in the papers today. But I think the two things are quite different. The LNG terminal is kind of a different issue where you're talking about importing gas. This is about just...
And LNG being...
A liquefied natural gas. So basically you bring in the natural gas in liquefied form into the country and ships. So it's a new way of bringing... Right now our gas comes through the Moffat pipeline, which comes through the UK. It comes from Norway to the UK, to Ireland. And LNG would be bringing in gas in liquid form in ships. And then when it arrives at the terminal, they transform it back into gas, and then you can burn it in whatever way you want to. So that was refused. That was going to be in County Kerry, but was refused this week because it is against government policy to invest in further fossil fuel infrastructure. And it doesn't really solve the problem, in my view at least, it doesn't really solve our problem of high gas costs, because the new gas coming in, you would pay the same price for that gas. It's just bringing it in another form. So it isn't a storage facility, which is probably more like what we really need. It was more like it was a private developer developing a commercial terminal to buy and sell natural gas, or okay, liquid gas, actually.
Andrea Martin, you've been looking at the tragic events then in Libya, and particularly the Sunday Times has extensive coverage. I think the most recent death toll, we're looking at 3,000, but fears that could go to 20,000 on foot of Monday's events. What have been some of your takeaways from the analysis today?
Well, there's a very informative analysis in the Sunday Times on the political background to these catastrophic dam bursts in Derna. As we know, since the fall of Colonel Gaddafi, there is a NATO-backed general in charge of the western side of the country, and a general, Khalifa Haftar, who is the subject of this article, who is in charge effectively of the eastern side of the country where Derna is situated, and seems to be running that part of the country somewhat at his personal fiefdom. Money was put aside for the maintenance of those dams, and there are questions to be asked about why that money had not been spent. It does strike one yet again that when NATO or the US get involved in trying to improve the situation of a country, it ends up in a much worse state. Whatever one may say about Colonel Gaddafi, there was at least universal free education and universal free healthcare. There is not one official hospital in Derna. There is a makeshift hospital in a villa I was reading the other day. But this is just unimaginably apocalyptic, and it could have been prevented. I'm interested in what Lisa might have to say about the climate change aspects of it as well.
And just to bring Pat in, like unimaginable, as you say, and yet, Pat, I think you believe this could happen again because of climate change, because of poor infrastructure.
Yeah.
What are your fears globally?
I mean, if you look at, and obviously there are a number of factors at play here, and Andrea has talked about them, you know, the political issues haven't helped. But I think there's a more fundamental issue in that a lot of the infrastructure that's put in place in a lot of these countries is inadequate. And it's definitely inadequate to cope with the new realities of climate change and storm, because I'm not sure how often places like Libya get storms like this or the flooding that ensued. I just don't think so. But, you know, we will have more of this, unfortunately, across the world, where infrastructure that was badly built, badly maintained, will cause serious injury and death in future because we haven't done enough to repair and maintain them.
Lisa Ryan, when you look at this through the lens of climate change very briefly, what are your fears?
Well, so we can see that, for example, the flooding there that arose was the rain that they got in one day was 260 times their monthly average. So, you know, this is an extreme weather event, and we know that climate change is going to cause extreme weather events. And the big issue with climate change and greenhouse gas emissions is the emissions have all come from developed countries, but the most vulnerable places are in developing countries who are producing very little emissions on a per capita basis, and yet they are going to be the ones that are going to suffer the consequence, and they have the least resources to deal with them and less infrastructure, less well maintained. So I think this is something that I think in COP meetings, what we're talking about now is developed countries reducing their emissions, but also paying poorer countries to help them adapt to the conditions they're facing.
So we've got to get that reactive and proactive preventative mode perfect. Our sincere thanks to all of you for bringing us through the newspapers this morning. Our panel was Professor Lisa Ryan, Andrea Martin, Kevin Doyle, Pat McCann.